From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. How does Google search the internet? How many people should you date before getting married? And how should you arrange your mattress to get the maximum wear out of it? Math can answer all of these questions. Stephen Strogatz connects mathematical concepts to topics in literature, philosophy, law, art, and pop culture. His new book is called The Joy of X, a guided tour of math from 1 to infinity. Strogatz spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on October 10th, 2012.
Thanks for coming out, everybody. Well, so I'm here to talk about The Joy of X tonight, and let me begin by saying a little about how it got started. It was on my 50th birthday that I found myself having a lunch with the op-ed page editor of the New York Times. Now, that's a kind of a strange thing to have happen, and it really, you know, maybe I should back up a little. How did I... First of all, he didn't know it was my 50th birthday. It's just that it's easy for me to remember when I was having this lunch with him because of that numerical accident. But anyway, he had said to me, next time you're in New York, come look me up. I had written some op-eds for the New York Times before, and this guy was about the same age I am. We have kids about the same age. So we had some chemistry, and he said, you know, so when you're in New York, look me up. And I thought, okay, I'm going to look you up. So I did, and he said over lunch, would you ever have time to write a series for the page, as he puts it, the op-ed page? And, you know, that was a wild idea. How do you write a series of math articles for the newspaper? What would that be like? And he said, well, actually, what I have in mind is something really for people like me, says the editor. I studied English in college. I was never really that good in math. I took math in high school. I even took up the calculus, he told me. And he said I could do okay, but I never really saw the point of it, never really knew what I was doing or why I should care about it. And I think there's a lot of readers out there like me who don't really know why they did all that math all those years. And it becomes an issue, especially, okay, so when you graduate from high school, you never have to do math again, except when you have kids. Right? That's the next time in your life that it suddenly comes rearing its head at you again, is that your kids are now asking you stuff about math. And you don't want to necessarily pass on your phobia to them, or if you can't remember how to do long division, it's embarrassing. So for all kinds of reasons, he thought that the readers would benefit or at least appreciate some kind of series about math. So could I do it? I said, yes, I could do it. And so that was the series that Ware mentioned in the spring of 2010. Now, so there was this first question was, what would the series be like? Now, one of us at lunch said, well, it's a newspaper, so it's got to be tied to the news. That is, there's always math in the news about global warming or about the economy or the census or, you know, I mean, you can always find math in the news. So tie it to the news. Actually, I usually tell this as a puzzle, but in fact, it's a terrible puzzle. It never works. The audience always knows. One of us suggested this thing about the topical. That was me. I thought it had to be topical. He said, no, not topical. I don't want it to be news. I just want you to start in kindergarten. Just begin with numbers. That's your first column. The second column is addition. The third column is subtraction, like that. That's how you're going to do it. That's the structure of your series. You're just going to walk us through the curriculum saying something interesting. Can you do it? So, you know, this was a fantasy for me because this is how any mathematician would think about doing it. I thought, yeah, seriously, you want that? So pedantic. I could do that all day. And he said, yeah, that's all I want you to do. Just walk us through and help us understand why the people who love math love it. What is it that they see that the rest of us don't see? So that's what I'd like to try to talk to you about tonight is, I mean, not so much teaching you how to do math. I'm guessing that a lot of people here are mathematical, though I would imagine not everybody. Would you mind telling me who you are? Like, if you think of yourself as a math person or a computer type or something, could you put your hand up? Okay, and so what about all you other people? What are you doing here? So put up your hands if you're the others. Yay, good. Oh, because actually, okay, so I'm writing for you. Now, I have to want to beg the indulgence of the math people who showed up. The way you could think of this, you math types, is this is one person's attempt to communicate to those other people. So you won't necessarily learn any math, probably you won't. But that wasn't really the goal of the series, and it's certainly not the goal of the book. It's something like the goal that Leonard Bernstein had, I like to think, when he used to do the young people's concerts. I wonder if anyone here knows about those. People of a certain age do know. People of a different age may not know. So you can look on YouTube and see what Leonard Bernstein was doing. He was a great composer and conductor, and he used to try to share the joy of classical music with kids. So it was music appreciation, you could put it that way. And so what I think I'm trying to do here is math appreciation. So let me give you an example of what I try to do. So here's the first column that appeared in that time series. Actually, let me put this one minimized. Just in case I forget to say it later, well, I'm not too good with the mouse pad. Okay, there we go. So in case I forget it later, the book includes the 15 columns that were in the original series, but then there are 15 more that are brand new that are just for the book. So here's the first one in the series, and also chapter one of the book, it turns out. And let me mention a couple things about it. I don't know how much you can read. Is that unreadable in the back? Should I read the text? Yeah. Okay. So it begins, by the way, I never wrote for the newspaper before, never on a deadline. And so there are some things I regret, including the first sentence. So the first sentence says, "I have a friend who gets a tremendous kick out of science, even though he's an artist." Do you see the problem there? Well, you want to suggest anything? I realize you're supposed to talk to the microphone, but I'll repeat what you say. What might be objectionable to some people about that first sentence? Yes, the people here in the front row certainly have it. The implication or the insinuation that somehow there's something surprising about an artist getting a tremendous kick out of science. The "even though" is the potentially offensive phrase there. But, you know, it is kind of what I meant that... that I was thinking, it is more notable if you don't necessarily expect a science-loving person to be an artist, although you could if you're less biased than I am, but anyway, so I have a friend who gets think of how you maybe should have, or what should I have said? I have an arty friend who gets a kick out of science. My friend the artist gets a tremendous kick out of science. These are not good sentences. There's a deadline, so this is the sentence I came up with, and it's not perfect, but let me continue. So I have a friend who gets a tremendous kick out of science, even though he's an artist. Yeah. Yes. It gets better. Wait till you hear the next one. It's a real zinger. Whenever we get together, all he wants to do is chat about the latest thing in evolution or quantum mechanics. All right, that didn't work. Okay, but when it comes to math, he feels at sea, and it saddens him. The strange symbols keep him out. He says he doesn't even know how to pronounce them. This is true. This is a friend of mine who's a very accomplished actor, and he does truly want to talk about math whenever we get together, or science. But he's always ashamed of himself that with math, he doesn't really know what's going on. So anyway, to continue, in fact, his alienation runs a lot deeper. He's not sure what mathematicians do all day or what they mean when they say a proof is elegant. Sometimes we joke that I should just sit him down and teach him everything, starting with 1 + 1 = 2 and going as far as we can. Crazy as it sounds, over the next several weeks, I'm going to try to do something close to that. I'll be writing about the elements of math from preschool to grad school for anyone out there who'd like to have a second chance at the subject. But this time from an adult perspective. It's not intended to be remedial. The goal is to give you a better feeling for what math is all about and why it's so enthralling to those who get it. So let's begin with preschool. But anyway, so this is the goal, and it's also the goal for my talk tonight. It's again, not remedial. It's to show you what I think some people find enthralling about math. Why is it so beautiful? What does elegant mean? So here we begin with preschool. This is, there's Ernie, but actually two other characters from Sesame Street will appear. You may be less familiar with them. I had not seen them before, Ingrid and Humphrey. And so they're working at the Hotel Furry Arms, and you're going to see what this is all about. Maybe I should just set it up. It says, the next line says, the best introduction to numbers I've ever seen, the clearest and funniest explanation of what they are and why we need them, appears in a Sesame Street video called 1, 2, 3, Count With Me, which I had seen with my kids when they were watching Sesame Street, and I really do think it's fantastic. So let's take a look. No?
Yeah. The phone.
I'll get it.
I'll get it.
I got it. Oh, man.
Oh, hold on. It's for you, Humphrey. Here you go.
Thank you. Yellow, furry arms, how may I help you?
We're hungry.
Well, what would you like?
A fish.
Fish?
A fish.
Fish?
Fish.
Fish?
How about you guys?
Fish.
Fish, fish.
You got it?
Well, let me repeat that. Fish, fish, fish. Fish, fish, fish.
You got it!
All righty, be right up with that order, Mr. Penguin, sir.
Yum.
Ingrid, go tell the kitchen. Fish, fish, fish. Fish, fish, fish.
Fish, fish, fish. Fish, fish.
Fish, fish, fish. Fish, fish, fish.
Not that easy an order, but I'll get it.
Ingrid and Humphrey, I have a better way for you to do this.
A better way?
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
Well, I just think it would be easier if you, count the fish.
Count them?
Really?
Mm-hmm. Look, I'll show you. Humphrey, you tell me the order, and I'll count with you.
Alrighty. Fish.
One.
Fish.
Two.
Fish.
Three.
Fish.
Four.
Fish.
Five.
Fish.
Six. See there? See what did I tell you? Now you know how many fish to send up. Six fish.
Holy mackerel! Mm-hmm. This counting thing can really save a person a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Does it work on other stuff? Say, cinnamon rolls?
Yep.
Cream pies?
Sure.
Spark plugs?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Wow.
He did it again. He may be the smartest person in the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Ingrid, let's go get those. What are they again?
Fish.
Fish, haha.
Oh, Chef, we need six. Count six fish.
So, the thing I want to emphasize there, actually two little points. So there are a couple of deep philosophical points in that. The first being when one of the characters says, these numbers can save a person a lot of trouble, right? That numbers are wonderful shortcuts. That's the first lesson. And that's probably what kids are supposed to get out of this, that knowing the concept of six can save you the trouble of having to say fish, 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 and also the possible confusion. You remember that the other character only says it five times because she hasn't heard right. So it's both more robust against error and also just simpler and more concise. But then there's a deeper point, which is the one that you were all chuckling at when they say, does it work for cinnamon rolls or spark plugs? Because you see, that's the real beauty of the number six or of all numbers, which is that they are more general than six fish. That is, six is the thing that six fish and six cinnamon rolls have in common. And so, but at a cost of abstraction, six is more abstract than six fish, right? I mean, maybe not to you. Maybe you think, I'm very familiar with six. Yes, but at one time in your life, six was mysterious. And six was an abstraction on par with something like truth and justice. That is, it's in the same Platonic realm that those lofty concepts are. And so, you know, that's a kind of interesting thing. Where do numbers live? That is, where is the concept of six? Six is not in the world. Six is somehow in our minds or in some Platonic realm, wherever that is. And so it really leads into very deep questions about how math can explain the world. If, you know, is math invented? Are we making up this concept of six? Or are we discovering it by our experience with six cinnamon rolls and six fish? So the rest of this first column got into this question of philosophy and the connection of math to science and so on. But anyway, by starting with something I thought would be pretty disarming, this clip from Sesame Street. Well, okay, then the question was, how would the world respond, if at all? And it turns out that there was a very surprising response, at least to me and to the editor, which was, so here I'm referring to this famous essay, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Math. I mean, it's interesting what you can do on the web. This you cannot do in the print version of the paper. Notice, I mean, I actually have a link to this video. It's very nice real estate being on the web, which I hadn't appreciated at first. I thought that the web was second class, that it would be better and more prestigious to be in the print paper. But in fact, the web is much better for teaching because you can use computer simulations, you can link to things. So here I can link to these papers that are interesting. And anyway, but the point was that the audience, so there it is, 546 comments. And wow, like look at that one in all caps. Here's somebody shouting, congratulations on your skills in making math so vitally interesting to read about, etc. That's the way a lot of them sounded. There's somebody who's criticizing with the world is linear. Okay, forget that. But there's actually another point there. You know, what do you do with comments? Because with the web, as with all of the blogosphere, people talk back. And you have to decide, are you going to read the comments? Are you going to respond to the comments? Let me go back to this issue of the deadline. Given that there was a deadline, I felt that knowing my thin skin, I should not read the comments because I'll spend the next week worrying about them and trying to defend myself and make a correction to what I said. And so I felt like my wife should read the comments. And she did. She read them and she classified them for me as more or less like 95% thankful, and these people are appreciative and very grateful. Thank you to the Times. Thank you to Professor Strogatz. And then there's 5% that she described as pontificators, who were people who either had corrections or improvements or were just generally smarter than I was. And actually, a lot of them had very good points to make, but it was, as I say, it would be very inhibiting to read those, and so I didn't read them. Still have not read them, actually. But I'm sure there's a lot of good insights in there.
Stephen Strogatz, the author of The Joy of X, A Guided Tour of Math from 1 to Infinity. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on October 10th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Stephen Strogatz in a moment, 824, 94.9 KUOW. A review of the week's news with Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times, Peter Jackson, the editorial page editor for the Daily Herald, Eli Sanders, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and associate editor at The Stranger, David Horsey, a political cartoonist and columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and you are invited with your contributions, reviewing the week's news tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. To people who grew up in the U.S. during the Cold War, the Soviet Union may have seemed like the exact opposite of their country, and the Soviets themselves may have seemed nothing at all like them. But it turns out kids in the U.S. and kids in the USSR had something in common. They both loved The Wizard of Oz, although the Soviet interpretation of Oz might not be recognizable to many Americans. An explanation tomorrow afternoon in the 2 o'clock hour. Weather forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows around 50, mostly cloudy. Chance of showers this evening. Friday highs around 60, partly sunny. Enjoy it while you can. Friday night lows around 50, rain likely. Saturday highs somewhere in the 50s, mostly cloudy. Chance of rain.
In today's world, it's important to stay informed. You can support KUOW by donating a vehicle. Just call 1-866-KUOW-CAR. Your gift will help maintain KUOW as the independent news source you rely on. Call 1-866-KUOW. Car.
KUOW thanks the generous individuals and entities that provided matching challenges during our fall membership drive. They include John and Harriet Morton, Bill and Delia Purdy, Sherry Richardson and James Montague, KUOW's Board of Directors and Board of Directors alumni, and 32 anonymous Broadcaster Circle members.
KUOW and Seattle Children's Theater present Danny, King of the Basement. With his life in transition, Danny's imagination and friendships trump his family's financial struggles. October 18th through November 18th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Stephen Strogatz is a professor of mathematics at Cornell University and the author of The Joy of X, a guided tour of math from 1 to infinity. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on October 10th, 2012. Strogatz began writing his book as a series of columns for the New York Times.
Okay, so the point was that first column was a very big hit and made it to like number 2 on the most emailed list. So it suggested that there was an audience out there for math in the newspaper and that people were hungry for it. In fact, the people I was looking for, the general audience of educated readers who were not mathematical, wanted something like this. So within a couple of weeks, my book agent said, "Where's the book proposal?" And I didn't have any book proposal in mind. I just was trying to finish the next column for the next week. But she said, "No, there's really a book here." And so we quickly fired up a proposal. And anyway, that ultimately became this book. Now, let me try to say a little more about this issue of elegance and what I'm trying to do. So I guess I could put it this way. My wife actually was, besides being a comment reader, was a very good barometer for what would be interesting or boring. She herself was just fit the description that the editor gave of readers who took math but didn't particularly like it or see any point in it. And so she would say, "I want each week you should have some kind of aha experience. I want something illuminating. I don't want to really learn math. I just want you to wow me or make me see something cool that I didn't understand before." So that was the goal. Each week, make my wife say aha. And in this context. Yes. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have thought of that except for your perverted reaction. So anyway, let me give you an example of how I might try to do that. There are all kinds of questions here, how are you going to do this fit for 15 weeks or for a 30-chapter book? Should I, for instance, talk about the history of math, all the human struggles to solve these hard problems, put some blood into the story, make it about people, because people like to read about people? Or should it be about the practical applications of math? People are always saying, "Where am I ever going to use this?" So it should then connect to all kinds of useful things about where math fits into the real world. Should there be proofs? A lot of people don't like the idea of a mathematical proof. Other people say that was the only good thing about math, was the logical reasoning that they learned in school. So my feeling was, I don't know what people want, and I'm going to try everything. That is, I'm going to try to just randomly push buttons in every direction and connect math to everything I can think of, and hopefully one week I will hit somebody's button. And so I don't feel that I should shy away from proofs or math arguments, because if we're going to talk about elegance, I want to show you what it is to experience an elegant argument. That's what it feels like to do math, and that's what people love about it who do love it. So I don't think there's any way of getting around that. So let me give an example of two that I think are elegant, and actually one that's very creative. So we'll resort to PowerPoint here, if you'll forgive me. Maybe just quickly, it just popped up, so I'll mention. The structure of the book is to just walk through the curriculum. So it begins with numbers. You could think of that as arithmetic. Second section is relationships. That's what I think algebra is all about. Not just numbers, but relationships between numbers, cause and effect, and supply and demand, dose and response. The third section is about shapes, so that's geometry. The fourth is about change, that's what calculus is designed to be, the mathematics of how things change. And then there's a section on data, which is all about probability, statistics, data mining, networks. And then finally, the frontiers of math, where we're at the borderland of what we know and what we don't, what we're still waiting to discover. So anyway, but back to this question of what does elegance look like. Let me try to show you an argument for the area of a circle. It's something you probably learned in school. You might have even memorized a formula for the area of a circle. If it has a radius of r, then there's a formula. Area is pi times r squared. Might sound familiar. A is pi r squared. But you probably never saw a proof of that unless you took calculus. You would have seen a proof in calculus, but if you didn't take calculus, you didn't see it in geometry class. And I'm not sure why not, because the proof is not that hard. In fact, I'm going to show you a proof that's very ancient, thousands of years old. We don't know who's responsible for this proof or who came up with it, but it's so pretty, I can't resist. So here we go. We'll start with a circle that's on the top, and then cut it into four pieces. And we're going to rearrange those four pieces into that shape on the bottom, which looks kind of like we haven't improved things. Because now we have to find the area of that shape. And that looks very unpromising. But I just want to mention two things about this shape. So if you look at it, first I should probably say, what is pi? Because we haven't said what pi is, so I need to define pi. Remember that the way pi is defined is in terms of the circumference of a circle. So the area, when you go around the circle, how far is that? It's longer than going straight across. That's the diameter. So the formula is that the distance across at the broadest part of the circle, the diameter, if you multiply that by this magic number pi that's a little bigger than 3, that will tell you how far it would be to walk all the way around the rim of the circle. So that's the definition of pi, the ratio of the circumference to the diameter. That's what we call pi. And so I'll take that as the definition of pi, and now I want to show you why the area of a circle, that is the space inside, is pi times r squared. So, all right, let's see. R, remember, is the radius, that's this distance, from here to that's half the diameter, distance from the center to the edge. And so here's a piece of the pi slice, this is r, because it's the same as that's r. And then here's the only real content in this picture, which is that this distance going along the bottom is half the circumference. Because look at it, I've got one round piece and another round piece, and there's the third and there's the fourth. So I have two of the four round pieces, so half the circumference. That is, it's pi times the diameter, but divided by 2, so that's pi times the radius. And so that's what I'm showing on the bottom, that the length along the bottom is pi r, and there's the radius. Now, so far it looks like this is like drama. Maybe you don't see the drama here, but in a good drama, things usually get bad for the hero for a while. And then there's tension, and then it gets better. So it looks bad right now. I mean, we made this dopey shape that seems like this is harder than a circle. Why would we do that? Well, because we have a notion. And the notion is that we're going to try, instead of four pieces, let's look at what happens if we do more pieces. Maybe just to show you where this is going before we get into it, that what makes it hard to find the area of a circle in the first place? I mean, why is this hard? If it was, you're doing something with your finger. Why is it hard? Yeah, this is such a good answer, because it's curved. I would say because it's round. Yeah, now what? Why does being round make it hard? Well, because areas of things with straight sides are easy. Like the area of a rectangle is easy, the area of a square is easy. They have straight sides. The area of round things is hard. And what we're going to do is pretend that it has straight sides. That's what we want to do. Now, to get there, what we're going to use is the power of infinity. Usually, people historically thought of infinity as paradoxical and their enemy, like mind-boggling. You don't want to go near infinity. There's all these paradoxes, Zeno's paradoxes. The Greeks didn't really like infinity in Greek math. They don't allow it. Yet Archimedes started to play with infinity a little bit because it is so powerful, and it's ultimately what leads to the success of calculus. The harnessing of, you may think of it as the domestication of infinity. You know, it's just like this tremendous workhorse that if you could tame it, it's fantastic. It's literally the case. That's what calculus depends on. So what we're going to do is make more and more of these slices. Instead of four, let me make eight. And I'm going to stack them up like that. Now, it looks like some kind of bizarre caterpillar or something there on the bottom, but the salient points to make are, again, that the bottom is half the circumference in length. See the pi r down there? And that side is still r, that straight piece. And notice, if you compare it to the previous one, that the r was kind of tilted there, and now it's standing a little more straight up. Do you see what I mean? So let me take 16 pieces. You see how it's standing more and more straight up? And, oh, someone's chuckling. Why is that funny? Because do you see the proof now? Can you see what's happening? What do you see happening? It looks more straight. It looks like it's trying to be a rectangle. Or a parallelogram. That would be just as good. Either way, it's trying to become straight, and the curves on the bottom are getting less pronounced. It's not as scalloped a shape. So, in fact, if you take infinitely many of these slices that are all infinitesimally thin, okay, that's mind-boggling. But so let's not go there, but let's imagine, you know, take 100 billion of these, and they're little skinny slivers. If you stack them all up, they would look like that. They actually would make a rectangle with pi r on the bottom and r on the side, which we know the area of a rectangle. There it is, pi times r, pi r squared. So that's the real reason why it's pi r squared. And what I like about this argument is the way infinity comes to the rescue. That is, you can't get this without invoking infinity, and suddenly it's really easy. So if that gave you any little aha or a little shiver or chill, I hope, like, that is really cool. That's the mathematical experience. And that's what we live for. Now, most of the time, we're stuck. That is, in math, like maybe if you're a writer, you know this feeling, you know, or a poet. Most of the time, it's not happening. You're trying to be, or an artist, you're trying to create something, and you're stuck. Your idea is no good. You don't see what to do. But occasionally, the flow comes to you, and it works. So, and it's a feeling of exhilaration. That this is, anyway, so this is what we're talking about with an elegant proof, or the reason why people love math is sudden insight. Here, let me try to give you another example. This one comes, this one is maybe to make the point of creativity. I want to show you a problem that you can think about a few different ways, because sometimes people will say about math, oh, what I like about math or what I don't like about math is that there's only one right answer. And it's true that there's only one right answer, but there's a lot of room for creativity in getting to the answer. And so it's not as authoritarian or rigid as all that. And so here's the problem I want to discuss with you. It's one of these contrived word problems that people often hate in algebra class. You may have even had this word problem. You could probably recognize it. It was told to me by my Uncle Irving. So my dad had a shoe store in our little town in Torrington, Connecticut, and his brother, Irving, was a partner with him, and so they sold shoes to the people in our town, and they knew everybody's name and actually their shoe size. But mostly it was my dad who knew that, because Uncle Irving wasn't so good with the customers. They would keep him upstairs in the office, and he would do the books. That is, he was good with numbers, not so good with people. And I found this out myself, both about good with numbers and not so good with people, when I used to see him after school and he would ask me math problems, give me puzzles. And so I might have been about 10 or so when he gave me this one. He said, suppose there's a bathtub and there's something funny about the faucets. The cold water faucet runs much faster than the hot water faucet. You see how there's like drip, drip, drip coming out of the hot. But the cold is really gushing in there. So the cold water runs so fast that it could fill up the bathtub in half an hour, just running by itself. Is this already bringing you flashbacks? Do you remember? Sorry, calm down, take a breath. Yeah, so the cold water could fill up the tub in half an hour, but the hot water running by itself would take an hour. How long? So 30 minutes for the fast one, 60 minutes for the slow one. How long would it take if they both run together, says Uncle Irving to me. And being 10 years old, I said 45 minutes. Right, so some of you are laughing just like Uncle Irving did. Because, okay, so why did I say 45 minutes? Well, one of them takes 30 minutes, one takes 60 minutes, so I'm taking the number in between. I said 45. Why is that a stupid answer? Because the one that would fill it in 30 minutes, running by itself, would fill it in 30 minutes. With the other one helping, it could only take less than 30 minutes. So it can't possibly take 45 minutes if they're running together. That's absurd. And so, okay, so there I am, humiliated 10-year-old. The reason I'm mentioning this part is that, well, a few reasons. For one thing, a lot of people have experienced this kind of humiliation, and it's that's another part of the mathematical experience. That is, it's why many people hate math or have math anxiety or stuff like that. And it's a reality. I think we have to talk about that, be aware of that, that this is part of what I have to address in this book, not like in a psychological way, but I mean, I need to be aware of it. The other thing, though, is that the psychologists tell us that when you have intense emotion, it helps you remember stuff. And so for me, the intense embarrassment helped me remember this problem all these years. And I've been thinking about it for years. Okay, so anyway, 45 minutes is not the right answer. Now, Uncle Irving said, here's how you should think about it. He said, think about what would happen in 1 minute. If you just watch what the cold water does in 1 minute, remember, it would fill up the whole tub in 30 minutes. So in 1 minute, it will fill 1/30th of the tub. And likewise, the hot water, which would take 60 minutes, in 1 minute would fill 1/60th of the tub. And so running together, they would fill 1/30th plus 1/60th. And then, you know, he probably asked me, do you know how to add fractions like that? And maybe, I don't remember if I did or not. But anyway, he said, okay, well, got to put the 1/30th over a common denominator. That's 2/60ths. And 2/60ths plus 1/60th is 3/60ths, which is the same as 1/20th. Still following me there? Good, yeah. Okay, so in 1 minute, you would fill 1/20th of the tub, which means it will take 20 minutes running together. Okay, so that's Uncle Irving's solution. That's the officially sanctioned solution, and it's correct. Nope, nothing wrong with that solution. But what I would like to do now is talk about a few other things you could do without adding common, you know, putting it over a common denominator. Let's look at this problem a few other ways to see kind of what I mean by creativity or playfulness in math. For instance, we already know that the answer has to be less than 30 minutes. But like, let's try to just get an approximate answer, which is sometimes very valuable. For a hard problem, maybe you can't solve it exactly, but you just want to be Sherlock Holmes and get some clues. So one clue is we know it has to be less than 30 for the reason I said a few minutes ago, because one of them will fill it up in 30 running on its own. So it has to be less than 30. But what else do we know? What makes the problem confusing is that the two faucets run at different speeds. Right? If they were running the same speed, it would be easy. I think. Like, suppose they were both running as fast as the fast faucet, so they each would fill the tub in 30 minutes on their own. So if they're running together, do you want to guess what it would take? 15? It seems obvious, right? If they were both running equally fast, it'd be like, here, you take the left side of the tub, I'll take the right side of the tub, and we can each fill half. And you know, that's right, 15 minutes is right. So if they were both fast, they would fill it up in 15 minutes. Now, how does that compare to the problem we were trying to do? Well, our problem was one fast and one slow. So it has to take longer than 15 minutes, right? Because fast plus fast would have to beat fast plus slow. So we already know, notice, without doing any common denominators, just common sense, that our answer is somewhere between 15 and 30 minutes, which is good. We haven't done any work. And it's somewhere in there. We know actually it's 20 minutes, but suppose we didn't. So it's somewhere between 15 and 30. Okay, now the next thought is, let's get the exact answer by some method that's more fun or clever than the common denominators. And so I thought about it for years and years, that what's really confusing about the problem is that, as I say, the different speeds, but also the fact that the hot and the cold are getting in there together and kind of sloshing around and getting mixed up. And that's confusing to think about. So I had this surreal vision one day of, suppose I could keep the hot and cold water separate. Like, the cold water is sitting there in the big faucet on the top, and there's bathtubs moving past, getting filled up. And then when they get filled up, they move on down the line, and then another bathtub gets filled up. So there's a conveyor belt, just to make it very vivid. And the same thing would happen down here with the hot water, bathtubs are sliding past, getting filled up on an assembly line. And so the question is, let's suppose we ask in 1 hour how many bathtubs would be filled up. Three is right, because one of them fills up one bathtub per hour. The other takes only a half hour, so it would fill two bathtubs per hour. So you would fill three bathtubs per hour. That's 20 minutes for a bathtub. That's it. That's the real reason. I mean, that's equivalent to the thing with adding fractions, but I like this picture because it's so zany, and you don't have to add common denominators. It's just obvious now why the answer is 20. So anyway, that's supposed to be an example of the playful side of thinking about math, and maybe a defense of word problems, which take a lot of heat. You know, people are always saying, nobody has a bathtub like that. That's true. I mean, you don't, right, it's not really supposed to teach you about plumbing. It's supposed to be to get you to think and to learn about rates and the relation between rates and, you know, what do you do if rates are different? Anyway, it's really supposed to be exercise for the mind.
Stephen Strogatz, the author of The Joy of X, A Guided Tour of Math from 1 to Infinity. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on October 10th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Stephen Strogatz in a moment. 847 94.9 KUOW. An unflinching look at the good, bad, and ugly of tumors. We'll meet the growth that killed Ulysses S. Grant. We'll meet Tasmanian devils battling contagious tumors and get to know the woman whose cancer cells changed modern medicine. That's tomorrow evening at 7. Weather forecast for the Seattle area for tonight: lows around 50, mostly cloudy. Chance of showers this evening. For Friday, highs around 60, partly sunny. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows around 50, rain likely. Saturday, highs somewhere in the 50s, mostly cloudy, chance of rain. Hear poet Joseph Green read his poem A Postcard from Salamanca, a portrait of a son far from home, absorbing news of his father's passing. Also, look at the lives and the work on radio of Boris Karloff, Peter Lorre, and Vincent Price, scary voice guys, and several Seattle area voters with a range of political viewpoints talk about issues and candidates on the ballot this time around. All these items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
KUOW and the University of Washington Simpson Center for the Humanities present geographer Victoria Lawson for the Fall 2012 Katz Distinguished Lecture in the Humanities, November 7th at 7 p.m. at University of Washington's Kane Hall. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
Hi, this is Liz Jones. KUOW welcomes all the new and renewing members who took part in our recent membership drive. Thank you for making this drive so successful. When you receive your pledge reminder in the mail, please be sure to return it as soon as you can. And thanks again for all your support.
Support for KUOW comes from TakeWinterByStorm.org, providing recommendations on winter storm preparedness, like keeping a first aid kit, warm clothing, and at least a 3 days supply of non-perishable food and drinking water at home, work, and in vehicles. Winter weather checklists and tips online at TakeWinterByStorm.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Math can answer a lot of questions in our daily lives. Everything from how many people should you date before getting married to how does Google search the internet? Stephen Strogatz is a professor at Cornell University and the author of The Joy of X, A Guided Tour of Math from 1 to Infinity. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on October 10th, 2012.
I felt that I should spend a lot of time on applied math. For one thing, that's something I love personally. My own work is mostly in applied math. And for those people whose buttons are towards applications, I want to show them some places where math connects to reality. And so, let's see, I don't think I have a visual for this, but let me mention an example of such a thing. 20 years ago or so, there was a horrible murder in Los Angeles. You may remember the O.J. Simpson case. And so O.J. was a football player, very well-known football player, later TV broadcaster, movie star. He had a wife, Nicole, who was found murdered, and also another person was murdered, a friend of hers, Ron Goldman. So anyway, this was this big, celebrated, contentious murder trial, and there was all kinds of complications in it, but I just want to focus on one thing here to talk about probability theory and how probability connects to the legal system in ways that can be confusing. Really confusing. So at the time of the trial, the prosecution wanted to make the case to introduce certain evidence about O.J.'s history of beating his wife, which there was really not much dispute about. Nicole had called 911 a few times. She had a bruised face. It was documented. There was really no argument that O.J. used to beat her up. People had more or less seen this. So let's take that as given, that he was a wife beater. I think there's no doubt about that. So the prosecution wanted to introduce that evidence because they argued that it's germane to a murder trial, given that we know that a lot of men who have murdered their wives previously beat them. The FBI and the police will tell you that that's true, that a person who's going to murder his wife often has a history of abuse. But the defense, in the person of Alan Dershowitz, said, that's not relevant and it should not be introduced. It's not admissible because we know that lots of men who beat their wives, most of them, in fact, only a tiny percentage of them will ever murder their wife. They could produce FBI crime statistics that showed that in a given year, the rate at which batterers go on to murder their wives is about 1 in 2,000 per year. Pretty infinitesimal percentage, to use the term that Dershowitz used. Okay, so give me a batterer. Odds are only 1 in 2,000 that he will murder his wife that year. So anyway, Judge Ito, the judge, the jury never heard any of this about the wife beating. Ito decided it's not admissible, and it didn't come in. But I want to talk now about how we should think about this probabilistically. That is it relevant or not? And what does it tell us? This is not my own analysis. This was published in Nature magazine a year or two after the trial. But what's interesting is that both sides were thinking about it wrong. Maybe on purpose, we don't know. But both of them are calculating or thinking about the wrong probability. The defense, remember, says what we want to know is the probability that a batterer will go on to murder his wife. It's low. The prosecution says we want to know something about the probability that, actually it's not so clear what the prosecution wanted. But here's really the right way to think of it. Or Dershowitz is doing it wrong. We know a key fact about Nicole, actually two key facts. She's previously been beaten by her husband and she's found dead. It's that second fact which is important and that he left out. That is, she's not just a random battered wife. She's a random battered wife who's found murdered by somebody. And so let's go back and do the calculation the right way. Let's accept Dershowitz's number, which is the right number, that the murder rate for battered women by their abusive husbands is 1 in 2,000 per year. The murder rate for women in general in the United States in the year 1994, or I think it was 94, was 1 in 20,000 per year. Okay, so here's the math you have to do. Let's look at a sample of 20,000 battered women and ask how many of them are going to be killed this year. This is so grim, but but it's an interesting calculation, and you'll see very relevant. Take 20,000 battered women. Nicole is in this population. Of those 20,000, one will be killed by a random person because the murder rate is 1 in 20,000 per year. But 1 in 2,000 battered women will be killed by their abusive husband or boyfriend. And so out of those 20,000 in the sample, remember, 1 in 2,000 are going to get killed. That will mean 10 will be killed by their partner, their abusive partner. So let's do this again. 10 will be killed by their partner, 1 will be killed by someone on the street, and the rest will not be killed that year. But we don't have to think about them because Nicole is in the population of people who are dead. So of the dead people, 10 out of the 11 were killed by their batterer. You get that? The odds are about 90% that if a battered woman is found dead, her partner did it. Doesn't prove that OJ did it. He may not have done it. He may have a good alibi. There could be all kinds of exonerating evidence. There could also be further incriminating evidence, like his footprint matches exactly. I don't need to go into the whole OJ case again. But anyway, the point is just that this probabilistic calculation is kind of tricky, and neither side got it right. And yet you can see that you can do it in your head with the relevant statistics. So I wrote this one column about what in math we would call Bayesian probability, which is a chapter in the book. It's a fairly sophisticated topic, but when approached the right way, it can be done with simple arithmetic in your head. And it's also very relevant, not just to murder cases, but to, let's say, something like the question of a woman who goes to have a mammogram, and she's in a low-risk group. She has no family history of breast cancer. She's 40 years old, has no symptoms, no reason to expect trouble. Her mammogram comes back positive. How worried should she be? And you ask her doctor, what are the odds that this woman has breast cancer? Give the doctor the relevant statistics. It turns out that doctors are all over the place in their estimate on this because it's one of these Bayesian calculations. It's quite tricky. But if you do it the right way, you can conclude that the odds are quite good that this woman does not have cancer because the rate of cancer in her cohort is very low. And also there are occasionally false positives on these tests. So it's more likely that the test came back wrong than that she actually has it, if you work out the numbers. Anyway, so these are really important things to understand, this kind of probability theory.
Stephen Strogatz, the author of The Joy of X, A Guided Tour of Math from 1 to Infinity. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on October 10th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW would like to thank Microsoft and its employees, the Real Networks Foundation, the Koenigsegg Goldman Foundation, the Cape Flattery Foundation, and our other corporate and private foundation contributors for their support of public radio and their commitment to building a vibrant community through corporate contributions and foundation grants.
Support for KUOW comes from Mirror Stage, presenting the West Coast premiere of Odin's Horse by Rob Kuhn, a modern twist on a classic Nordic myth at the Ethnic Cultural Theater, October 24th through November 11th. Tickets at mirrorstage.org, theater that gets people talking.
Join KUOW and the Kabiri for Beneath a Wing-Darkened Sky, an elegant dessert theater cabaret featuring aerial acrobatics and contemporary dance at Youngstown Cultural Arts Center in West Seattle, October 19th.